Support comes from Kappa, presenting An Evening with Fran Lebowitz, March 6th at the Southern Theater. The evening will feature an unapologetically opinionated talk moderated by Ann Fisher, audience Q&A, and book signing. Tickets at kappa.com.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Former Ohio Supreme Court Chief Justice Maureen O'Connor last week said that it's a matter of when, not if, voters get to decide a proposed constitutional amendment to reform how legislative maps are drawn in the state. She called the exercise complicated, time-consuming, and costly, but that the final product will be comprehensive and free from loopholes. Speaking before the Columbus Metropolitan Club last week, she pledged to work toward that goal.
Now that I'm retired, you know, I can be involved with efforts to maybe pass another constitutional amendment. And this time, the constitutional amendment depoliticizes the redistricting commission. Mm-hmm. There would be no elected officials on the redistricting commission in an ideal format.
It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Joining us this week, Joe Ingles, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Welcome back, Joe.
Great to be here.
And Andrew J. Tobias, statehouse reporter for Cleveland.com. Welcome back.
Happy Monday.
And Haley B. Miller, political reporter for the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau. Welcome back.
Good morning.
So, Haley, former Supreme Court Chief Justice Maureen O'Connor spoke to the Columbus Metropolitan Club last week. She said a proposed constitutional amendment to again change redistricting, or how redistricting occurs in Ohio, is a matter of when, not if. So how does she plan to help make that happen?
So she hinted that she was interested in this before she left the bench. And now that she is retired, it seems to be a pretty big point of focus for her. So she said she's in conversations with people about what this would look like, how this would work. She wouldn't disclose who she's working with and is kind of keeping all of her cards close to the chest at this point. But she has expressed an interest in an independent commission before, a redistricting commission that does not have any elected officials on it. That seems to be a big goal of hers. And so, you know, seems like this group is aiming for the 2024 ballot. You know, she has said that this is complicated. You have to be very thoughtful if you're going to try to change the Constitution. And, you know, as someone like her who's involved in this process, you know, she's going to be very meticulous and, you know, leverage her legal background to make sure that this works.
She said it's going to be costly. Any statewide race or ballot issue is costly in Ohio. Have they raised any money? Does anybody know?
They haven't said, but just to kind of put a point on it, you know, these days it's actually more expensive than it used to be because there's less petition firms out there than there were. There are fewer people in the labor pool who are willing to stand in the cold and ask strangers to sign pieces of paper. So the cost of collecting signatures is almost doubled, is what some people in the world have told me. So maybe $5-6 million just to qualify for the ballot. And then let's just say this is on the ballot in 2024. And it's proposing to take a huge share of power away from the Republicans who currently dominate the Elections Commission or the Redistricting Commission. There's going to be a lot of ads. So I think the big question about this is, you know, when this passed previously, the current system, which was a reform of the old one, was meant to be an anti-gerrymandering reform, but didn't really work out that way. It passed because the Republicans and Democrats kind of reached a consensus on it, and there was no formal opposition. So any campaign to do this, it's going to be not only very costly, but also very hotly contested. And, you know, that's just, it's very challenging to get all the money in place to do something like this. I just it's just something to keep in mind as this story kind of develops.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. That is Andrew J. Tobias, statehouse reporter for Cleveland.com. Also with us, Haley B. Miller of the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau and Joe Ingles of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. One way that they can confuse the issue is for the Republicans to put something else on the ballot that would compete with it and kind of muddy the waters. It's been done before. Any thoughts about that?
You know, I think that's what we're going to find. If you remember how the current redistricting proposal got in place, it failed. There were several different tries at different versions of redistricting that failed at the ballot box. And the problem with redistricting is that it's not something you can really easily explain in an elevator speech. And you got to remember, most people go into the polls, they're paying attention to a slate card that they get in the mail. They're paying attention to, you know, some 30-second ad that they saw or some conversation with, you know, the local Joe down at the diner. They're not necessarily getting, you know, I know our listeners know all about redistricting, yeah. and they could tell you everything about it for the most part. Mm-hmm. But that's not the average. The average voter just doesn't have that information. So if you throw something out there, some dangly thing, we saw it happen with the marijuana petition. Mm-hmm. It became all about monopoly, remember? And so I think, you know, we could see that again with a redistricting proposal. We could, you know, there could be something that they some issue in it that the opponents are able to twist to their benefit. They wouldn't necessarily need their own, you know, agenda or their own counterpoint.
Okay.
They could just confuse it. But the one thing I do want to point out is back when this current redistricting process was on the ballot, the ACLU of Ohio did not support it. They didn't go against it, but they didn't support it either. And the reason was that they felt like it still gave politicians the control and they could still gerrymander. Fast forward to today, what's happening? So, I mean, there was a hint of a warning that this could happen, mm-hmm. and it came from lawyers
Absolutely.
Who
I
saw
mean,
it.
And so the question is, did the ACLU get involved this time around?
I don't know. That's a good question.
If it meets their criteria. And I'm also wondering about Democrats, the Democratic Party in Ohio, where it stands on it.
Well, you know, there was certainly a lot of talk among Democrats during this latest redistricting process about how Republicans just really thwarted the process, completely disregarded the Ohio Supreme Court's rulings on these maps. So if Democrats aren't just all talk on this, you know, they probably will come out in favor of an independent redistricting commission. But that does also take the power out of their hands if that passes, because there are a couple, you know, Democrats on the commission, obviously more Republicans than Democrats. But, you know, they still have a seat at the table right now.
I mean, there was a chance some years back for a little bit more reform than we've seen when now Lieutenant Governor, but then House Speaker, what's his name?
John Husted.
John Husted. Thanks.
Fill in the blank.
Yeah, fill in the blank. Was Speaker of the House, and the Democrats dissed it.
Yeah, so kind of the circumstances have changed now compared to back then. For a long time, or, you know, for a period of time anyways, you know, like you said, John Husted was interested in this. It was something that people had talked about before that, but Republicans always had the threat of Democrats taking over. And so, like you said, in Husted was pushing this from like the 2006 to 2010 period, and Democrats had the chance to strike a compromise, and they kind of bet that they were going to win in 2010. They did not.
They lost everything.
And then again, you know, talks picked up around the 2015 period. There was concern from Republicans that Democrats might win in 2016, particularly in 2018. So that the threat of kind of a grassroots and maybe even Democrat inflected redistricting measure kind of forced Republicans to the table then. I think that they're unlikely to think that they're going to lose their power at this point with the way that we've kind of seen the last 8 years or so of trends kind of play out. And so it's a lot harder for me to see Republicans kind of getting forced to the bargaining table to, you know, willingly relinquish anything. And by the way, like, what would the campaign look like to oppose this? I mean, I remember the 2012 campaign a little bit, and I remember there was like, you know, this is a power grab from unaccountable bureaucrats and they want to blah, blah, blah. And particularly if Democrats become supportive of this, you'll probably see Republicans try to politicize it and say these are Democrats trying to like make an unaccountable
power
grab.
They must have something to gain by this.
And so it's just, you know, things change, but it's much harder for me to see the conditions for any kind of compromise on this, given how, you know, how well Republicans have done electorally in recent years.
Well, and even, I mean, talk about a lack of willingness to really do anything on this issue, even right now. I mean, the last maps were only in place for the 2022 election, so they have to go back to the drawing board at some point. And I mean, we are in budget season right now, so that's part of it, but they clearly aren't in a rush to do so. They've also pitched the U.S. Supreme Court on upholding the maps that they drew. So, you know, they seem very firm in their stance right now, even on how this latest process went.
Yeah, as for that, the U.S. Supreme Court, when it rules, I mean, it did it?
It has not. No, it's currently considering a North Carolina case Ohio's Republican legislative leaders are basically trying to jump into. And I'm not a lawyer, but my understanding of that has always been that they're arguing that state legislative leaders have, you know, kind of unchecked power to draw the lines as they see fit under their interpretation of constitutional law and stuff like that. I believe that would basically fundamentally undermine the reform in that the way they designed it was that the court can strike it down if it's, you know, if it doesn't meet these standards. But if you're saying that state legislators have, you know, supremacy to decide what they want to do, there's no real accountability built in no matter who's in charge. So I just that could be something to keep an eye on is. Any kind of reform measure would have to operate within, you know, if there's a ruling in that case, if they accept Ohio's arguments, you know, it could
it's
influence
a pretty,
what happens here.
Outside outlier argument, though, or has been.
Yeah, traditionally.
Traditionally, but.
I'm not a Supreme Court guy. You know, apparently it's maybe like there's some of the new justices are kind of sympathetic to it and some aren't. So it's one of those things that, you know, there's no ruling yet, but my perception of it is it could be a close ruling. Hmm. So
let's see. Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost has signed on with more than a dozen other state attorneys general warning two pharmacies against selling abortion medication. Why did Yost get involved considering that Ohio law requires a doctor dispense the medication anyway?
Well, political points.
Yeah.
Oh, politics.
Yeah. Well, okay. I don't know. I asked that very question of Attorney General Yost's office, and I have yet to receive an answer. I did talk to Ohio Right to Life President Mike Gonadakis, and he said that, you know, he's been saying that, yeah, the law would prevent that from dispensing in Ohio. He would prevent that. But he says that, you know, hearing it from Ohio Right to Life is one thing. Hearing it from the attorney general signing on to this, it's an important way to get that message out there to these pharmacies not to sell abortion pills. Now, to be clear, what we're talking about here is mifepristone and that's the two. I'm getting them confused. It's the two drugs that induce an abortion, the two pill combo. We are not talking about what's commonly called the morning after pill.
Right.
Okay. So I want to be clear because people get really confused about that. But these two drugs right now in Ohio, you can only get this two drug cocktail for an abortion by going to a doctor that provides an abortion. You can't just order them online or pull up at the CVS and get one right now or get that prescription right now. So this FDA rule that was put in place, it basically was for the pandemic so that people had the access during the pandemic when a lot of the clinics and doctors weren't around. Mm-hmm. But they've made it a permanent thing now at the FDA. So the question is, how many pharmacies jump in? What states are these pharmacies in that jump in? And what will the scope of the provider, What would it be? Can they, you know, send them across state lines? Can they do this or that? Still kind of feeling their way around on this one.
And, you know, the basis of the Attorney General letter was that Biden has overstepped his authority on this issue. It's my understanding that, you know, CVS and Walgreens have come out and said, you know, there probably will be some states like Ohio where we don't dispense these medications because of state law. I mean, they don't want to get in trouble. And to me, all of this just really underscores a lot of the confusion that has come about since the Dobbs ruling, because everyone's trying to figure their way out around the post-Roe landscape and what's legal and where. And it's been really hard for patients and I think even medical providers to keep track of all this.
We are going to take a break. It is our weekly reporter roundtable. That's Haley B. Miller. She's a political reporter for USA Today Network Ohio Bureau. Also with us, Joe Engels of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau and Andrew J. Tobias of Cleveland.com. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Bring Race might be a hot topic right now, but for so many of us, talking about race is nothing new. On the Code Switch podcast from NPR, we go beyond the headlines and we go deep. Listen now.
Welcome to All Sides. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Governor DeWine, in his State of the State address last week, signaled that education and the well-being of children are at the top of his agenda. He proposed big funding increases for traditional public schools, vouchers for private school education, and aid for charter schools. House Democratic Leader Allison Russo of Upper Arlington wondered where the money to pay for all that would come from. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us, Haley B. Miller, political reporter for USA Today Network Ohio Bureau, Joe Ingles of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, and Andrew J. Tobias, Statehouse reporter for Cleveland.com. Andrew, can you give us a thumbnail of what the governor's proposing in education?
Yeah, the big thing, there are two components. One is that there is fundamentally, it's a big increase in education funding that the last that was included in the last budget. It was a push to try to make Ohio's school funding system be constitutional in compliance with the 2000 ruling that it wasn't. The criticism before that was that, you know, there's so many so much reliance on local property taxes that it creates, you know, inequalities based on, you know, local wealth. And so the previous budget increased funding dramatically, changed the formula. It hasn't been found to be constitutional, but nobody's sued over it yet. So I guess it's constitutional until, you know, deemed otherwise. But so that's in place. And that's something like, I think it's like $1 billion at least. It's a very large outlay that they chose, that the governor chose to fund in his budget proposal. The other big piece is that there's also a major reform of private school vouchers that you can basically use tax dollars to allow kids in lower performing school districts to then attend the private school of their choice, you know, and there's a certain amount of tax dollars that it makes available. So not only did Governor DeWine increase the you know, the income level that you would be able to be eligible for that, and they also increased the amount of money that an individual kid could get to pay for it. And so that's another something like $150 million, I think, annually that's included in the governor's budget. And so what didn't go as far as to basically make a universal voucher system where anybody would qualify for it. But Republican legislative leaders like Matt Huffman has basically said it's the income eligibility has increased so much that it's functionally like what they call the backpack bill, that almost most families would be able to qualify for a private school voucher under this plan.
Okay, so the state, you know, the state rainy day fund is flush, you know, with money. The state coffers are flush with COVID money. But even with that, the governor really wasn't too specific about where the money's coming from. Is there a reason why? Is that a negotiating type of thing?
So my general understanding, another thing that's interesting that's in this is that there's a $2.5 billion with a B dollar economic development fund that the governor is pitching. And, you know, my sort of limited experience covering previous budgets is that often, you know, the numbers are pretty tight and that you sort of have to, you know, in order to increase funding somewhere, you cut somewhere else. Mm-hmm. That's, $1 billion is a lot of money. And so we have, you know, we expect that some of the money that's in this is going to be paid for still by the remaining federal stimulus dollars that President Joe Biden signed into office, giving states a bunch of money, which explains in part why Ohio has a record level of rainy day funds mm-hmm. to begin with. But there's no new tax revenues proposed in this. So it's not like the governor's suggesting that we increase taxes to pay for anything. You know, we're still kind of looking through this, but yep. I'm not aware of any major cuts that he's proposing either. So it just kind of seems to me like this is all money that they think they can just spend based on what they have in existing revenues. And so it'll be interesting to see if Republicans go for that.
And there's a new agency that's being created. It's the Agency for Children.
That's a whole other thing, yeah.
But if you listen to what he said, it's going to combine several different agencies into the under that agency. So that could mean reorganization of government. It could mean attrition of jobs. It could mean we don't know how that's going to play out. But that could save a lot of money if you start putting, you know, several different agencies into one. You might need one person to do the job that five people are doing right now. So we won't know that because that won't show up immediately. The Blue Book was released the day after his budget. So we can see that it looks like the Blue Book is, and the Blue Book is the budget plan, by the way, the governor's budget plan.
The actual numbers.
Mm-hmm, the actual numbers. And it does look like there is funding available for the things in the governor's plan, but it, as far as the specifics as to how those numbers come about, we're still working through that.
With the Department of Children and Youth, or whatever it's called, it's my understanding that they're basically moving the money around. So money that would have been in Health and Human Services, for example, is just getting shuffled over to that new department's budget instead. You know, as Joe noted, we still don't know, I think, whether that there are any cuts as part of that. But another interesting aspect of this revenue conversation is that in past budgets, you know, Republicans have expressed an interest in continuing to cut income tax brackets and maybe even pursue a flat income tax. And I think those conversations are still going to be alive and well this time around. So if you're cutting, if you want to try to cut taxes and also spend more money, that doesn't really work. So
Senate President Matt Huffman questioned some of the proposals for committing spending in future years when times may be leaner. How did the governor respond to that?
I don't know that he has yet, but we do know, like, this week that the committee hearings are scheduled. I believe it might even be tomorrow, but Kim Murnix, who's the governor's budget person, is going to basically be addressing legislators, explaining some of the details to this, and also fielding their questions, and I'm sure that will be among them. But generally, when you talk about future funding years, I mean, you know, it's a two-year budget, and so people just kind of can change it as they go. And so that's never really tied, you know, lawmakers' hands too much before, because, you know, it basically has to get reapproved every 2 years.
So as far as this new Department of Children and Youth,
mm-hmm.
is that, you're saying combining several, is that including the Department of Education?
I think there are some aspects of the Department of Education budget in there. I feel like it has to do with like childcare or.
Yeah.
So it's basically taking anything kid related in other departments and consolidating them under one agency. This is a big, I mean, you heard it in his State of the State, and you've heard this from the governor even before now. He's always been very interested in sort of the livelihood of children and building their future, etc. And so this is probably one of the more dramatic efforts he's made on that front, I think.
And if you look at Governor DeWine's past history, you can figure out that he is very into what's known as wraparound services, which mm-hmm. means that schools right now have mental health services, behavioral health services, physical health services. They have different services coming from different departments. So it's possible he could just, you know, take those departments and throw them together. He didn't really say how he wants to do this. So he could, you know, combine the departments, he could reorganize duties, there's any number of things he could do to make this work, but he wants it to be something, I think, that's less siloed in a way and have it more in one place. But it could have the effect of saving money too, if, you know, depending on how it's done. And we don't know. That's the big question mark right there. How do you do this? What exactly is consolidated?
It could have the effect of saving money, but is that something that he touted about this?
No, he
okay.
did not.
All right. Because it also could end up costing a lot more money.
It could end up costing more happens. Money, I guess.
Yeah, and really, when you think about budgeting in the state, I forget what is it, eds, meds, and beds. Is that like the phrase that people use? But it's education. So it's K through 12 education. It's Medicaid, which is, you know, healthcare for low-income people and disabled people. And prisons. And so that's really where you can make changes from a fiscal standpoint. Mm-hmm. So when you start talking about consolidating government offices and stuff like that, it makes a difference, especially if the numbers are tight. But really what moves the needle in the state, you know, dollars, it has to do with those three topics. And so when you're talking about increasing school funding, when you're talking about increasing private school vouchers, it can really make a difference. And I guess the other thing that can make a difference too is if they were to cut taxes. But the governor, since taking over, has been reluctant to do that. Ohio's been cutting taxes for years, and that's sort of an ideological commitment that Republicans have. So there is a $2,500 tax deduction for parents per child that they can claim, which is not the same as saying you get $2,500. You reduce your taxable income by $2,500. So like, I think that translates to like $100 or something like that. And there's also making certain stuff that you would buy for a baby exempt from sales tax, which is something like, I think it's like $6 per $100 of goods or something like that. So that's the major tax change that's contained in this, but the sort of fiscal impact that of that is pretty limited when you actually add it all up. So it'll just be interesting to see how much Republicans want to cut in the legislature want to cut taxes by. I don't think it's a if, I think it's a how much, just because of the conversation that we've had even not only for years, but also just kind of within the last few weeks or months.
Yep. In higher ed, did you say this, that the governor wants to give $5,000 annual scholarships to any Ohio high school student who graduates in the top 5% of their class?
No, we had not mentioned that, but that is one of the more interesting aspects of his budget, to me at least, and that was something that got big applause from Democrats, too. I don't know how that adds up. You know, there are obviously only so many kids in the top 5% of a class, but you know, that's a big incentive, and it's part of this larger goal of trying to curb, you know, so-called brain drain.
And also, it should be noted that kids who graduate in the top 5% of their class are getting full ride scholarship offers anyway. So I don't know, do they get $5,000 to go play with then or what? I mean, if you look at the way that the colleges, you know, talk about their funding, the group that kind of isn't getting the help is the A-minus B student, you know, that maybe doesn't attract a full ride scholarship, but still could be a very good college student and graduate. They don't get that help a lot of times, but a lot of times the universities are jockeying for the top five.
That's what stood out to me is, are they the ones that really need it?
Yeah. And I don't know what happens if they get a full ride scholarship, or is that just to relieve state universities so they don't have to provide so much in scholarships? I don't know.
Well, and you know, if students are just getting $5,000 in their pockets, I mean, theoretically that could help with day to day living costs and things like that. But you know, it does beg the question of, you know, if this money is better spent elsewhere. But you know, the governor and lieutenant governor really want to keep young talent in the state, and this is
But is there a requirement that if you take the $5,000, you're going to stay in the state?
It
means you'll go to school here, but
yeah, I mean, you could leave after 4 years at OSU.
The big drain comes after college.
Yeah, that's where the brain drain is. Yeah, and if you talk to the kids who are leaving the state after they graduate college, I teach at a college, and I talk to my kids about, you know, what are your future plans, and the reason they leave Ohio has nothing to do with you know, where they got a scholarship or that kind of thing. There's a lot that goes into that, and that's a whole nother show. But, you know, brain drain is not a function of not having the money to go to college. It's other things.
And Democrats were very quick to point that out.
Yeah. You know, I can't, before we get off the educational bus here, Haley, last week you reported on the neo-Nazi lessons that an Ohio couple taught to their, well, not just taught to their own students' children, but to were delivering and downloading to about 2,000 other people out there. Before this, the General Assembly moved to loosen oversight of homeschool curricula. What has been the feedback from the Ohio General Assembly about what was going on and what regulations might have had played a role in it?
So Democrats say Ohio homeschools are not regulated enough, and really no homeschooling in any part of the country is that heavily regulated. In Ohio, parents have to agree to teach like 900 hours, and they have to educate their kids in certain subjects like reading, math, etc. But beyond that, there aren't that many requirements. ODE isn't approving or reviewing any curriculum, and no other states are doing that. So honestly, compared to a lot of other states, Ohio has few more rules in place than others.
They're talking about relaxing even those rules in this Senate Bill 1, right?
Right. So this would go further. And, you know, Democrats say that's a problem because, you know, already the rules that we have in place aren't doing enough to clearly to curb things like, you know, neo-Nazism being taught at home. Republicans have condemned the, you know, racist anti-Semitic language that came out of these reports, but you know, Senate President Matt Huffman said that the situation shouldn't be used to punish all homeschooling parents. You know, he doesn't know that a stricter policy would prevent something like this. And something that came up in my conversations with, you know, observers and experts in this issue is that if you try to regulate homeschool curriculum too closely, you get caught up in like First Amendment issues and it becomes very hairy. So, you know, Senate Bill 1 is a lot broader than just the homeschool aspect of this. And it's a high priority of the Senate president. So I assume that bill will eventually pass.
Yeah, fundamentally, the issue is that if you have people homeschooling their children, the school isn't, you know, the state education department isn't going to send people to observe what they're teaching in their homes. And so the materials that this family was supposedly teaching their kids and also sharing on the internet wasn't approved by the state. It wasn't approved by their local superintendent or anything like that. So, you know, Reardon McLean, I don't know if you interviewed him or if it was one of your colleagues, but he's the state lawmaker from Upper Arlington. He's a conservative Republican. And his viewpoint was basically you can't punish the vast majority of, you know, sort of homeschool families who, you know, they can have a religious program, you know, or whatever, things that we wouldn't find in a typical public school for this extreme outlier. And it raises the question of, you know, what exactly would prevent this kind of thing in the future? And, you know, I just don't know what the answer to that is.
And he also made an interesting point, and, you know, you can agree or disagree with this, but he was like, you know, a kid could be going to a public school and coming home and their parents could be spouting neo-Nazi ideology.
Yeah, so, yeah, that's true. I read that, but I'm also thinking about what if, is there another iteration of objectionable educational curricula that might change their mind on whether it deserves to be regulated? I'm trying to think about something that Ohio House Republicans or Ohio Republicans tend to abhor.
Yeah, maybe something like gay and trans rights.
Yeah, LGBTQ rights or CRT. Critical race theory. What if there, you know, I mean, what if, even though that is not taught in Ohio schools.
It is not.
But what if it was a curricula available on the internet? I don't know. I just wonder.
One thing that I would like to point out, if you're a teacher in the public schools, there's these things called lesson plans. And like every day that you're in school, you're going through and you have lesson plans. And those are reviewed by other people in the school to make sure that number one, they want you to hit the curriculum that you're supposed to be hitting through the state standards. But number two, lesson plans are developed so that it's detailed and people, you know that it's hitting what it needs to hit.
But even in private schools, even in
a lot of private school teachers have lesson plans. I have friends who work in private schools and they have lesson plans.
But do they have to have them?
I believe they do. Okay. I don't know. Someone could correct me on that. But most private school teachers I know, and I'm just going to verify it that way. Most private school teachers I know have someone who is helping them, you know, kind of overseeing the lesson plans at their school. It's not just the wild, wild west. A teacher just doesn't go into the classroom, start teaching anything they want, and never having any idea of what they're doing.
But a homeschooler can.
A homeschooler could.
All right. We are going to take it. By the way, next hour, we're devoting an entire hour to this neo-Nazi website that is now closed down, but was letting people download curriculum, neo-Nazi curriculum all over the place. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Mm-hmm.
Race might be a hot topic right now, but for so many of us, talking about race is nothing new. On the Code Switch podcast from NPR, we go beyond the headlines and we go deep. Listen now.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The internal fight over Republican control of the House, and more importantly, maybe, the purse strings of a pile of campaign cash may be headed to court. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us, Joe Ingles of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, Andrew J. Tobias of Cleveland.com, and Haley B. Miller of the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau. Haley, Representative Phil Plummer, a Republican from Dayton, said last week that he's hired an attorney who's prepared to take House Speaker Jason Stevens, also a Republican, to a court. What's going on?
So, Plummer and Representative Derek Marin and that contingent of Republicans, you know, are
Marin
still...
Marin being the man who would be
right.
Speaker.
You know, they say that they are the head of the Republican caucus. They held their own elections of sorts to determine that. They do have the majority of Republicans in their caucus. The Stevens supporters are in the minority of the Republicans in the House at this time. So Plummer and Marin say, as head of the Republican caucus, they are entitled to control the purse strings for campaigns, the campaign fund that they use to help House Republicans, you know, win re-election and win election. Speaker Jason Stevens says, I'm the speaker, this is mine to control, basically. And traditionally, the House Speaker has been in charge of that fund. But there's no rule that stipulates this. So, you know, it sounds like if Stevens doesn't just automatically hand over the keys to the kingdom, you know, Plummer and Marin are going to pursue a challenge in court over this.
Huh.
And well, I don't even know what grounds they would be suing under, so that should be interesting to see, but...
I know you're not a lawyer, Andrew.
He just plays one on radio.
What do you think?
I think, I mean, again, I just don't really know what relevant laws would say to what's kind of fundamentally a political dispute here. But I know basically there was a vote prior to the Ohio House adopting rules, which late last month, which essentially is laying out how they're going to do business and accept bills. Derek Marin and other Republican caucus members held a vote, and Jason Stevens and his supporters actually didn't show up to that meeting. And so afterwards, Stevens was kind of making light of it as like, oh, people have, they call themselves caucuses. They can do whatever they want and say they're a caucus, you know. But apparently a majority of House Republicans voted, selected Derek Marin as the, quote, you know, House Republican leader. They selected Phil Plummer as the House Republican campaign leader. And so the question is that legally binding? You know, I don't really know. A lot of times, like I said, these things kind of get resolved through like political arguments and stuff like that. So legally speaking, who knows? You know, we'll see.
From what I understand, Stevens has the key to the realm, that being the credit card associated with the House campaign caucus money.
Yeah, that's my understanding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, this is what happens, folks, when you have supermajorities, because you have factions within that supermajority that can divide. And mm-hmm. actually, the Democrats, who have been so outnumbered in the legislature, at least on the House side, they have a little more sway because they can be pulled in. That's how Jason Stevens mm-hmm. became the speaker, you remember.
Well,
the Democrats
not the first
were
time,
pulled
that's
over. Yeah,
Larry
it's not the
became
first time.
Speaker, too.
Yeah, the householder.
But
did
the difference with when Householder got elected to speakers, he was able to pretty quickly unify his caucus.
Right.
I mean, he whipped people into shape and got everyone behind him. There was not this division that you're seeing
right.
now with Jason Stevens and Derek Marin.
And there hadn't been a pre-vote that conflicted with the whole House vote.
There was one, but the Householder Republicans boycotted it. So when this pre-vote occurred in November, the entire Republican caucus showed up. And so there's sort of an understanding that they would, you know, adhere to the results. But it is, I don't really see a great difference between what Householder did and what's happening now. I think that Stevens basically saw the playbook and used it. But, you know,
I kind of wondered, though, about that. It's kind of a question as far as the 22 that changed their vote. in the Republican caucus that ended up going with Stevens over Marin, if they're torn over they voted for Marin in November among the caucus vote. I'm just wondering.
Yeah, what we're seeing, if anything, is some of the pro Marin Republicans are starting to kind of drift into the Stevens camp. And okay. I think it's, as opposed to like being huge Jason Stevens fans, I think there are some who probably don't really see the value in kind of going all out and fighting this fight. You know, Stevens was able to get some of the pro Marin people to agree to accept leadership positions. He appointed a number of them to committee chair positions and things like that. So we'll kind of see, you know, so, and also that House rules vote that I mentioned, I forget what the number was, but maybe like 8 or 10 pro Marin Republicans switched right over to vote for that. So I think that Stevens is going to hope to consolidate some support and kind of deal with this. But at the same time, there's clearly a faction of the sort of Marin camp that is very upset about how this went down. And you're seeing local Republican parties vote to censure the Stevens
right
Republicans even now. So
what's
just
the governor doing? Who's he talking to? Who are his people working with?
He's been very coy about this. He was asked about it before his State of the State a couple weeks ago, and he said, you know, his office has an open door policy, but, you know, generally the three leadership positions in state government are governor, Senate president, and House speaker. And he said he expects things to continue that way. I believe after the State of the State last week, Marin said he had been in touch with DeWine's office or planning to meet with him to chat about the budget. So to an extent, it sounds like DeWine's, you know, willing to have multiple conversations. But I think at the end of the day, he sees Stevens as the, you know, elected leader of the Republicans in the House.
There are a couple of kind of funny things. You know, one is that when those committee assignments were given out that I mentioned, Derek Marin was appointed the vice chair of the House Ways and Means Committee. He was previously the chairman. So that's just kind of like a little slight, you know, that yeah Stevens threw his way. And then I don't know if he meant this or not, but Matt Huffman, when he was kind of asked about this last week, the Senate president kind of momentarily forgot Jason Stevens's name, which, you know, like the House Speaker is a very important position. If you were a Senate president, that would be high on your list of people to know.
Remember
and recall. So I feel, you know, Huffman has made some comments, you know, reflecting the reality that this is kind of a complicated political situation and he's kind of has to maybe work with both of those people. But, you know, the governor has not really wanted to weigh into this, and this isn't really his thing. The governor's always kind of hasn't appeared to me to be somebody who wants to micromanage the legislature. So I'm sure
hasn't been able to micromanage him.
Yeah,
better.
Maybe he would if he could.
Yeah, I think
he hasn't gotten in there and gotten his hands dirty. So I'm sure he just enjoys letting this one kind of play out without him having to
getting dragged into it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But here we are in February, and you know, the legislature really hasn't done much, at least on the House side. They haven't done a whole lot. And there's a lot that needs to be done by the end of June, primarily this big budget mm-hmm that we need to have in place so that people get paid and things get done. There's also redistricting, you know, if they do nothing, which I think that's a very real possibility. But you got to have, you know, if you were going to do something, you'd want to tackle that if you were going to try to fill in
well,
the mandate.
Well, they missed the deadline for on the chance to preempt a planned abortion rights ballot
right
measure.
Exactly.
So
that's another thing.
There's that.
Yeah, but I want to say why this matters ultimately. This, you know, we're talking earlier about the education things that are in the budget. We're talking about the tax things that were and weren't in the budget. If there's a number of Marin people who don't want to agree with Stevens to approve a budget issue, maybe he has to turn to Democrats. And so maybe that's, you know, they're mm-hmm trading tax cuts yep for education funding, or they're trading voucher expansions for tax cuts. And just the whoever the trading partner is that Stevens is going to have to turn to will really make a big difference on what those kind of like, you know, decisions, you know, turn out to be. So that's exactly why this stuff matters. Besides, it's funny to, you know, point rattle off like kind of personal slights that people are throwing at each other and stuff like that.
The Householder trial continues. Former Speaker of the House, Larry Householder, former Republican Party, Ohio Republican Party Chairman Matt Borges, have been charged with what's the conspiracy?
Bribery, racketeering.
That's right. And according to testimony on Friday, First Energy, in this case, and its allies were counting on former Ohio Republican Party Chairman Matt Borges, and his connection with Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost to kill a 2019 ballot effort to block the $1.3 billion bailout in House Bill 6. It's all in a nutshell. What position did Yost take on that ballot issue? Where was he on that? He rejected one version of it, I know, but he passed let another one go by.
Yeah, so the Attorney General's role in that whole discussion was that whenever you want to repeal a piece of legislation, you have to first prepare the language that the repeal would look like on the ballot. And so the Attorney General's office has to verify that the description of whatever it would do accurately matches what they're proposing to do. And then they also have to, yeah, it's the form of that. That's actually it. And so it's not uncommon for the Attorney General's office to reject the first iteration of the language, mm-hmm. and that's what he did. Maybe somebody might question, you know, whether there's sort of an appearance of impropriety because of what we're learning through this trial, but nobody has alleged that there's anything improper about the way that they did that. And then the second thing that the Attorney General's office was involved with on this was that you can't repeal a bill if it is found to be a tax or if it contains an appropriation, and it cannot be subject to a referendum. Mm-hmm. And there was this really aggressive legal push from First Energy while they were trying to kill the, you know, foil the petition gathering process. They also attempted to get Yost to declare that this thing was not subject to referendum laws. And so Borges's job was to kind of push both of those directions.
And they were saying Yost. That because the House Bill 6 attached ratepayers were footing the bill for this, right. And they were calling that
there's
a tax.
There's a fee, and the Republicans were saying it wasn't a tax when their opponents during the debate were trying to accuse them of raising taxes with this. But then it was a tax if they're trying to make sure it can't be repealed. So really
double
illustrates the political opportunism that was playing out here for sure.
Well, and another interesting part of this involving Yost is that there was a text at some point, indicating that Yost personally did not support the legislation and didn't think it was a great idea, but he was getting support from First Energy, and so he was kind of like, whatever. But Yost has been subpoenaed to testify on behalf of the prosecution in this case, so we'll probably hear more about his role in this down the line.
He and Matt Borges, to wit, by the way, do have a long-term relationship. I mean, they have
close political advisor. Yeah. I'd describe them as friends. They were friends at the time. And just to kind of be fair to Yost, during the petition gathering process, one of the things that the First Energy forces did was they hired petition blockers to follow around the repeal signature gatherers and to interrupt them. And Yost, at one point, after things got out of hand, there was somebody who was charged with assaulting the other side, called on the petition blockers to not harass the signature gatherers. He was kind of intimating that it was like a violation of their First Amendment right to free assembly and all that stuff, and threatened to basically, refer them to be prosecuted. So Yost did speak out against what he saw as misconduct by the sort of pro House Bill 6 forces. And so it's, maybe he may have been more vocal had, like, to Haley's point, had he
support
not been deferential.
Support for WBOSU comes from Cordoba.
Go ahead.
But yeah, he was on the record as being critical of sort of some of the tactics that side was employing.
Well, we have about a minute, and I'm wondering I'm curious what you guys think about what U.S. Senator J.D. Vance, the Republican, has been. He looks like he's been honing his conservative credentials lately, and it's kind of, some people thought maybe he might trend a little bit more to the center, but since he got elected.
He's come out on the gas stove issue, and then this weekend he has, when everyone was thinking about the Chinese balloon, he had the picture of himself with some big scary gun sitting there ready to shoot the balloon down. I know these are like conservatives probably, that's probably like something that they love.
Red meat, right?
Yeah, they're red meat, but it wasn't necessarily speaking to the needs of what a lot of Ohioans say that.
I mean, he was on Steve Bannon's podcast last week. Thoughts? I mean,
he is very much, I think, above any other issue, and this isn't surprising given what he said on the campaign trail, but he's making a big thing of, U.S. funding for Ukraine. He wants an accounting of it. He wants a stop to it. And that, more than anything else, is what he's been drilling down on in his first few weeks in office.
Okay, that's all the time we have. Andrew J. Tobias, Statehouse reporter for Cleveland.com. Thanks for your time.
Sure.
And Joe Engels of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Thank you.
Always great to be here.
And Haley B. Miller, political reporter for USA Today Network Ohio Bureau. Thanks for your time as well. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's it for now. Thank you for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.